Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3045 et al. United States of America versus Walter Anderson, appellant. Mr. Axum for the appellant, Ms. Hart Mahan for the appellee.
May it please the court, Tony Axum representing the appellant Walter Anderson. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Anderson challenges on appeal the district court's disregard of Gall's mandate that courts properly calculate the applicable sentencing guideline range and use that guideline range as a starting point in arriving at a sentence. This error adversely affected Mr. Anderson's right to be sentenced in accordance with the ex post facto clause because the district court used guidelines that were enacted after the completion of Mr. Anderson's offense.
Could we not consider that just surplusage since the plea agreement, the agreement was that he wouldn't get any more than 10 years and he didn't get any more than 10 years. He got 9 years. I mean, that was the bottom line of the plea agreement.
The plea agreement only limited the court insofar as it could not impose a sentence of greater than 10 years.
Right,
that is correct.
And it didn't.
And it did not.
So all the rest seems like commentary.
Well, there's still a procedure to be followed during sentencing, and I think the Supreme Court has gone to lengths to lay out what that procedure is and should be. And Gall specifically says that courts should properly calculate the guidelines, and the guidelines should be the starting point. Here, the district court used a starting point that was improperly calculated because it used the wrong sentencing guidelines.
Well, there's no question that the district court understood the range under both the 2000 and the 2001 guidelines, right? No doubt about that.
There's no doubt that the district court understood both ranges. That's
right.
Correct.
And there's no doubt that he said that he was going to give the same sentence regardless, that he thought this was the appropriate sentence, and that he would give the same regardless of whether the 2000 or the 2001 were the proper guideline, right? Yeah, I'm just saying he said that, right?
The district court issued an order the day after sentencing saying that.
Right.
During the actual sentencing.
Well, you think hearing, he lied? My question is, do you think he lied? Do you think the district court lied on the record when he said that the sentence he gave was the same sentence he would give under any guideline?
I don't think that the district court lied. The district court is certainly entitled to do that.
He said that's what he did. So in order for us to decide otherwise, we'd have to say that the court lied in his order. Isn't that right? Why isn't that right?
It's not right because the court's failure to articulate how or why it would arrive at the exact same sentence using a starting point. The starting point under the
That's a different question. So now you put your finger on a different phrase, failure to articulate. So your argument is not that the judge didn't apply the two guidelines. It's just he didn't explain why the same result should occur under both. Is that right?
I believe the arguments are interrelated. On the one hand, he used the incorrect guidelines to arrive at a sentence that we're arguing was substantively unreasonable. But separate and aside from that, he certainly did fail to articulate how he could rely on two separate versions of the guidelines as the starting point and yet arrive at the exact same sentence. And Gall requires so much.
Gall requires more of an articulation.
Certainly.
So did you object below to the extent of the articulation?
I won't say that there was an objection to the extent of the articulation, because first of all, the order came out the day after sentencing in which the district court said that. But primarily, below, the defendant was arguing that the lower guidelines should apply.
Right, but we have several cases that say, and they're cited in the briefs, that if you don't object, if the problem is the failure to sufficiently articulate, and you don't object, then we have to look at that question from a plain error point of view. You agree that that's the standard for the issue of articulation? Dorsley is one of those cases, and there's another case that's cited in the briefs. I think it's Ginyard, actually.
I agree that that where a court has failed to articulate reasons, counsel should object if they feel that, that the reasons are either insufficient or there's an utter failure to articulate reasons. Mm-hmm. However, in this case, the district court did not dismiss the 2000 guidelines for specific reasons at the original sentencing hearing related to Mr. Anderson's history and background or the facts and circumstances of this case. The court dismissed the 2000 guidelines and refused to use those because it found that Mr. Anderson had waived any claim to the ex post facto clause, which is certainly something that we challenged.
Right, so the language in the court's sort of discussion with the parties during the sentencing, where it sounds like he's saying he could rule under either guidelines, and where he stresses the fact that this case involves, I don't know, the largest personal tax fraud in history, something along those lines, and says that he thinks that while, you know, something less than the ceiling that he's given, which is the maximum of 120 months, is appropriate under those circumstances. And where he says in the later document that he has examined all of the sentencing factors, why isn't that sufficient to survive plain error review?
Well, I don't concede that it would be plain error.
I thought you said you agreed that there's an obligation.
I mean, the standard would not be plain error.
Well, as a general matter, where the court fails to articulate the reasons for a sentence, I do agree that a plain error standard would apply. I can't say that it would apply in every situation. This is a situation that I don't think the plain error standard should apply because the defendant was not provided an opportunity when the court issued the order the next day to say, Your Honor, you have not articulated reasons for the variance between 57 and 71. And 108 and 120, because below the discussion did not center on variance at all. The district court dismissed the lower guidelines by finding that Mr. Anderson had waived any right to have the court even consider the lower guidelines under the terms of the plea agreement.
But then he,
go ahead.
The next day, said, by the way, I would do the same thing if the 2000 applied.
And that's precisely my point. He did that the next day without an opportunity for counsel to then stand up and say, well, you're not providing a reason for why you would arrive at the same sentence using two different starting points. Mm-hmm. So I'd submit that plain error would be inappropriate here because we were not afforded that opportunity.
Ask a question about the restitution.
Yes.
Or do you want to make an argument about that?
I would. I would. With regard to the restitution, we would ask this court to affirm the district court's finding that it lacked the authority to impose restitution in this case. Both of the issues, the first issue concerning the proper use of the guidelines, but also the restitution issue, turn on phrases within the plea agreement itself, the plea agreement drafted by the government in this case, and the district court properly construed the plea agreement against the government. The plea agreement, the paragraph containing the restitution clause, references 18 U.S.C. 3572 and 16 D.C. Code, Section 711. Section 3572, as I note in the filings, is a fine statute, but it does not make the restitution clause incoherent. In fact, it provides perfect coherence for the restitution clause because this restitution clause allowed the government to seek restitution solely under the D.C. Code of Fitts, which is what the court imposed.
But then it would be the same as if it hadn't used the words Section 3572 at all, right?
It would.
So are you saying that so what was the point of including 3572 is plainly inapplicable here. What was the point of putting it in?
Well, I'm not so sure that it's inapplicable. It's a fine statute that references restitution and says that when a party besides the U.S. government restitution is to be ordered to be paid to a party besides the U.S. government, which the D.C. government would be, a fine would be inappropriate. So,
what does that have to do with? It's under a section called restitution.
Right.
Your position is that 3572 is only about fines, right?
It is about fines, but it is separated by one word from the D.C. Code section that references restitution, that did provide the court with authority to impose restitution on the D.C. Code count. So it's understandable the U.S. Code site is near the D.C. Code site because it is advising the court or the parties that a fine would be inappropriate because restitution is being sought under the D.C. Code to be paid to a party other than the United States government.
So you're saying that the reference to 3572 is to bring into consideration that there ought not to be a fine that would make it impossible to pay restitution to the District of Columbia?
That's correct. I don't mean to be presumptuous. I that is an interpretation.
Okay. Let me ask you, the court can derive its authority to impose restitution solely from the agreement, and not this agreement, from an agreement that meets sufficient
clarity. Certainly.
Okay. So if this agreement, if an agreement can confer this authority, why look to 3572 for authority as opposed to what it really does contain that's relevant, namely criteria? It has a list of criteria to be taken into account in calculating, in that instance, a fine. And they're saying, one reading of the contract would be, we've agreed you can order restitution pursuant to the criteria in 3572 and the criteria in 711, which also has criteria, right?
That's correct.
And that makes sense of their reference to the statute. It invokes those criteria.
That's correct.
Okay. So then what's the problem? What's your objection?
Well, we are not challenging the district court's imposition of restitution with regard to the D.C. Code offense.
I understand that. But what's the problem with 3572, with the contract, with the agreement, insofar as it references 3572 to incorporate those criteria for the determination of the amount of restitution? Why isn't that a fair reading of the contract?
I believe 3572 references restitution insofar as it, as a court should determine a fine.
Oh, yes, it does. I understand that. But they could have said, we will agree to restitution in an amount to be determined by the court according to the criteria in the Idaho statute for child support. They could have done that, couldn't they?
They could
if
have done
that.
That's
what they agree on. Then the court wouldn't be deriving any authority from the Idaho statute, nor would it be giving child support. It would be using those criteria. That seems to be what's happened here.
The difference in the two situations is the reference to an Idaho statute would have no meaning within the plea agreement. This can be read to have meaning within the terms of this plea agreement.
Well, why wouldn't it have the meaning that it imports those criteria in the Idaho hypothetical Idaho statute? Your bottom line is that this agreement did not contemplate restitution under the to the United States, only to the District of Columbia, right?
Our position is that there is no evidence that there was that the parties had agreed that restitution would be paid to the federal government.
Why did your predecessor spend 2 days in a hearing on the calculation of the amount owing to the United States before coming up with this argument that nothing was really contemplated?
I'm not sure of the timing of the argument, but
The argument, we're told without contradiction, the argument first appears on the third day of the hearing after there's been expert testimony for 2 days from both sides about the amount that should be paid to the United States.
And the government presented during that testimony an official from the D.C. Office of Tax and Revenue who said that we do not do our own independent calculation to determine what taxes we are owed. We rely solely on the calculation from the federal government. So
they had to determine the federal amount, even if it's hypothetical, in order to derive the district amount.
They certainly did.
I see. All right, we'll see if the record seems to read that way. Okay.
I have just two more questions. When we were talking before, I think you were making the point that the judge did not decide on using this alternative sentence, that is, under the older guidelines, until after the sentencing hearing, right? But I'm looking at appendix page 584, and this is during the March 27th hearing. He says, unless I've got the wrong I, it says, if I were applying the old guidelines because of ex post facto considerations, I did not think that 71 months was a sufficient sentence because these are now advisory sentencing guidelines under 3553A. I could vary upward so long as I did not exceed the total statutory maximum 60 plus 60 or 120 months. So I think that's all I have to say about which guidelines apply. Now, he does say that during the oral discussion with counsel, right?
He does say that, but I'd note that that is conditional and that he is not saying that is what I am doing.
It says if I were applying them, wouldn't that be the time to then raise the objection? Well, that you can't just say that, Your Honor. You have to say why. You said you didn't have an opportunity to object to the degree of explanation provided.
But the court had not announced the sentence by then. We are still arguing that the court should use the 57 to 71 range.
Right, but when the court does, in the end, give a higher sentence, he does that orally during that same discussion. Why couldn't the objection? This is the only time that an objection about degree of explanation can ever be given, either during the oral discussion with the court, during the sentencing hearing, or as a motion to reconsider the sentence afterwards, which wasn't filed. But leaving aside that it wasn't filed, why couldn't the attorney for the defendant have argued that, well, if you're going to do that, if you're going to give a sentence here that's higher, and it clearly was higher than the 2001 range, than the 2000 range, why didn't, Your Honor, you have to explain the difference?
The court would have to explain the difference, but at that point, I think that the court was still speaking through what it was going to do. and it would seem odd as the court is speaking.
Well, what about at the moment when the court says what the sentence is? Why not then?
At the moment that the court says what the sentence is, the court is providing reasons for the sentence, but not reasons for having. The court has not indicated that it is varying or actually did vary from 57 to 71. The problem in this case is that the court said the guideline range that you are asking me to use as my starting point is not the proper guideline range. The court did not say, I am varying up from the proper guideline range and I'm not providing you.
He's providing an alternative. We have upheld alternative sentences before. Before Booker came out, when judges said, if the guidelines were this, I would give this, and if the guidelines after Booker turn out to be indeterminate, I'll give this. And we said that was okay. And here are the judges saying, if I were going to apply the old guidelines, I would still give the higher sentence. And then he goes on, less than a page later, and said, again emphasize, this is the largest personal tax evasion in the history of the country. And that's the reason why I think a sentence slightly lower than the ceiling is the right sentence.
In the prior cases, prior to Booker, where alternative sentences are given, the court is not faced with two separate guideline ranges from which it must start and then vary upward. The court is faced with a sentence that it perhaps believes is just in contrast to the guidelines. Here, the difference is the court is faced with two separate guideline ranges, and it's not saying I'm varying upwards from this guideline range. It's saying, as a matter of law, you're wrong. I don't have to start with 57 to 71. The objection is, Your Honor, you do have to start with 57 to 71. Once the court has made that decision, it would seem odd that the attorney would have to say, although you have dismissed my argument that the lower guidelines should apply, I'm going to object that you did not vary from the lower guideline that I said should apply. And that's why we are, if the court had not issued an order the day after saying I would have imposed the exact same sentence.
What the court's order says, and you obviously disagree with this characterization, is that that's what I was doing all along, not that I suddenly issued an alternative, but that, as I said in the transcript, that's what I was doing. So it may be that you feel that there wasn't enough notice about that, but the judge didn't say, I've changed my mind, I'm now going to give an alternative sentence. He says that's what I did.
Well, I suppose I'm left with accepting that is what the judge did, and it nevertheless defies logic that the guidelines can be central to sentencing for all courts, and you can have such a significant difference between two guideline ranges, and the court throughout the sentencing says, I'm considering this guideline range, but the day after sentencing issues an order saying, even if I had considered a much lower range, I would have arrived at the exact same point. It almost makes the guidelines sound meaningless in this case, which courts are certainly permitted to.
Well, that's the consequence. In a way, that's the consequence of Booker, isn't it? They, as long as the judge knows what the different guidelines are, and this judge clearly knew what they were, and as long as he says he's looking at the 3553A factors, and he clearly said he was, and as long as he articulates a reason why he thinks a higher than guideline sentence is appropriate, and he did, the consequence of Booker is that both the government and the defendant have to live with the fact that the judge doesn't have to follow the guidelines anymore.
I agree that no one has to live with the fact that the judge has to follow the guidelines, but the guidelines are not meaningless, and that is the point that this court reached by its post hoc decision or post hoc explanation that it would have applied the exact same sentence. If that reasoning were allowed to stand, all a court need do in any case is at the end of sentencing state, and regardless of, and even if I have applied the guidelines wrong or calculated the guidelines wrong, I would have come to the exact same sentence. I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but Gall and Booker require more from the courts. They require explanations. It was a procedural error for the court to improperly calculate the guidelines, to use the wrong guidelines here, and the government bears the burden of showing beyond a reasonable doubt that it did not affect the sentence. And that is not clear, even though the court could, on remand, impose the exact same sentence. We don't doubt that, but the procedure outlined by the Supreme Court was not followed here, and Mr. Anderson was entitled to that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
May it please the court, my name is Alyssa Hart Mahan, and I represent the United States in this case. I want to briefly address the term of imprisonment imposed by the district court before turning to the restitution issue in this case. First, there was no error in the district court's use of the 2001 guidelines. Both the plea agreement and the statements made during the plea colloquy make clear the defendant knowingly and willingly exposed himself to the use of the 2001 guidelines range at sentencing. He cannot later claim unfair surprise when his counsel specifically stated that the range would be 108 to 135.
But he didn't know that the proper range was under a different set of guidelines. When you say knowingly and willingly, he didn't know what the actual guideline should have been.
That may be, Your Honor. However, defendant pled guilty to tax evasion for the 1998 and 1999 tax years. The conduct underlying those offenses did end before the 2001 guidelines took effect. However, the plea agreement explicitly stated that the court would be required to calculate and consider the 2001 guidelines range in this case.
So what do you draw from that? That his counsel was ineffective? How does that help you?
That he knew that was part of the bargain, Your Honor. The government agreed to dismiss counts that included conduct that continued after the 2001 guidelines took effect, specifically count one of the indictment. Part of the plea negotiations, the government agreed to dismiss that count, but one of the government's terms of the plea agreement was that the 2001 guidelines range would be the advisory guidelines range that the court would begin with. And the court recognized that the provision in the plea agreement that specified the use of the 2001 guidelines range was essentially a paraphrase of the way post-Booker sentencing practice works. The court is obligated to calculate and consider, but is not bound by the 2001 guidelines range. In any event, even if this court were to find that the district court erred in using the 2001 guidelines, any error was clearly harmless. The district court articulated many reasons for the imposition of the 108-month sentence. In this case, this explanation was clearly adequate, whether it was a within-guideline sentence or whether it was an upward variance from the 2000 guidelines. I believe the phrase he used was, this is as serious as it gets when it comes to tax crimes, and the 108-month sentence was clearly justified. If the court has no further questions on the term of imprisonment, I'll turn to the restitution issue. The parties in this case clearly intended to authorize the district court to order restitution. The plea agreement states that the defendant agrees that the court may order restitution pursuant to both a federal statute and a D.C. statute. Now, the federal statute cited in the plea agreement deals with fines rather than restitution. However, the plain language of the plea agreement, in addition to other evidence of the party's intent, makes clear that both parties intended that the court could order restitution. It was not a mandatory term, it was a permissive term, but that both parties intended to authorize the district court to order restitution.
What is your explanation for the U.S. Code provision?
Ineffective
assistance of counsel?
it was a human error, Your Honor. It was.
Most counsel are human.
Yes. And that it was an oversight. It was a mistake.
Can I ask you, this is off point because you have waived this argument, but I guess I don't understand the argument that Ginyard requires that supervisory release be mentioned in the plea agreement. It's clear that under the statute, if supervisory release is appropriate under a plea agreement, restitution is also appropriate, right?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
It's clear under, there is another statutory provision that permits as a condition of supervisory release restitution.
Yes.
And you have given up that argument because you think that Ginyard stands for the proposition that unless supervisory release is specifically mentioned in the plea agreement, it can't be given, right?
I don't want to concede that we've given up. We've given up that argument.
You've given it up on appeal. It's not mentioned anywhere in the brief. And in fact, I think you say somewhere in the brief that you're not raising it.
We do not mention it in our brief, and the trial attorneys below conceded that issue. However, this court has, if it believes that the district court has misinterpreted Ginyard, this court does have the discretion to correct
that. Well, help me with the interpretation of Ginyard for a moment. My understanding about, Ginyard is a case in which the defendant agreed to 24 months, and the court gave 24 months plus, that is 24 months as the max in prison, and then the court gave that plus supervised release. And I understand the argument that in that kind of situation, if the defendant agrees to a ceiling, you can't add additional time, whether you call that time supervised release or probation or something else. But it would seem unusual that if the defendant agreed to 10 years, And the judge had two choices, 5 years in jail plus, or 7 years in jail plus 3 years supervisory release, or 10 years in jail, that it would be okay to jail the defendant for 10 years, but not to let him out in 7 years and give 3 years of supervised release.
We believe that the appropriate interpretation of Guignard is that the plea agreement in this case capped the term of imprisonment at 10 years, and thus the combination of imprisonment and supervised release cannot exceed 10 years.
Combination, right.
Combination. So in this case, the district court imposed a sentence of 9 years. And if this court were to find that...
You could have given 9 years and 1 year of supervised
release. And 1 year of supervised release.
But you could,
with restitution as a condition.
But you didn't raise this argument, and you conceded below that it couldn't be done, I thought.
We did not raise that argument. However, it is related to the party's intent. And if this court were to find that the parties intended restitution only as a condition of supervised release, this court could remand to the district court to give it, to provide it with an opportunity to impose supervised release if it thought that was appropriate. For a number of reasons, the better interpretation of the plea agreement is that the parties intended restitution as a separate part of the sentence under 18 U.S.C. 3663A3. And there are three main reasons that support this interpretation. First, there was no mention of supervised release in the plea agreement. Second, there was no mention of supervised release during the plea colloquy, and contract terms must be interpreted in light of the intent of the parties at the time they entered into the agreement. And finally, if the plea agreement had provided for supervised release, a separate restitution provision would have been unnecessary in the plea agreement because, as Your Honor noted, the supervised release statute grants the district court discretion to impose restitution as a condition of supervised release. In sum, the language of the plea agreement here, the fact that the defendant explicitly agreed that the court may order restitution, defense counsel's statement during the plea colloquy that the government is free to seek restitution, and the fact that both the government and defendant presented expert testimony during the sentencing hearing.
Wait a minute. The latter point about being free to seek restitution could be related solely to the District of Columbia, couldn't it?
That's correct. They did not specify whether it was to the federal government or the District of Columbia.
Is there anything in the hearing that suggests that it had that, in fact, the defendant was acknowledging that the restitution could be ordered for the United States?
Not during the plea colloquy. However, during the sentencing hearing, both the government and the defendant presented expert witnesses who testified specifically to the amount of federal restitution.
Mr. Axum says they had to do that in order to establish the amount for the D.C.
If this were only a D.C. tax case, the government would not have presented, the government would only have presented an expert witness as to D.C. tax law. A separate expert as to federal tax law would not have been necessary.
Wasn't it the case that the D.C. expert would have had to say it's X percentage of the federal amount and here's what I think the federal amount is?
The D.C. expert would have had to testify to that. I would also point out, Your Honor, that at no point during the sentencing hearing did the defendant object to the calculation of federal restitution amounts. In fact, at other points during the sentencing hearing, defendant argued that the federal restitution amount should be lower than the amount that the government was arguing for.
Where's that?
I can provide
There's
that.
There's a lot of argument about whether it's more or less than $100 million, right?
That's correct. Defendant was arguing that the court should use the lower tax percentage for an individual rather than the higher corporate rate. And so at various times, defendant argued that the proper federal restitution amount should be $70 million. At a later point, they said $100 million. And the government consistently argued for $140 million. I'd be happy to provide the court with citations by letter this afternoon.
If you could find a citation in which it's clear, or as clear as it gets, that the defendant is acknowledging that this is restitution to be paid to the United States rather than part of the necessary calculation of the D.C. amount, that would be helpful.
Do you think you can do that
during the course of Mr. Axum's 2 minutes or so of rebuttal?
I will try. I'm not sure that...
Well, if not, how about submitting a letter by...
I can submit a letter this afternoon.
4 o'clock today?
Yes.
Obviously copied to Mr. Axum.
I would also point out, Your Honor, that the plea agreement did not merely cite a D.C. statute, but it also cited a federal statute. Now, we concede that it was the wrong federal statute, but that goes to the party's intent that restitution was available for both the federal and the D.C. counts.
Well, how does citing the wrong statute go to the intent?
If the parties had only intended restitution as to the D.C. count, they need only have cited the D.C. statute. There would not have been a federal statutory cite in the restitution provision.
Well, the federal statute says don't impose a restitution that makes it impossible to pay the fine, right?
That's one portion of it. That is subsection B of the statute. Subsection A authorizes the court to impose fines. So it's.
And was there any fine here?
No, there was no contemplation of a fine at any point. There was no fine.
So why isn't the explanation simply that it was the wrong statute and it was just a mistake, perhaps a fatal mistake, but it was just a mistake?
We freely concede that it was a mistake.
You don't admit that it was fatal, though?
No. No, not in light of the clear and clearly expressed intent of the parties and the actions of the parties during the plea colloquy and at sentencing.
On the consequences of this, you can still bring a civil action for recovery of the tax, right?
Yes. In fact, such an action is underway.
So the only difference is whether you get the money or, I guess there's some question about whether you're going to get money anyway, but whether you get a judgment for restitution or you get a judgment at the end of that proceeding.
That's correct. However, here, for instance, Your Honor, the district court could have said, well, because the government can collect this through civil proceedings, I'm going to exercise my discretion not to impose restitution. But that's not what happened here. The court said, I find that I have no power to order restitution. So,
the consequences to the federal treasury are only a question of whether you get it sooner, that is, you get the judgment sooner rather than later. I take it you don't have any doubt that having gotten a criminal conviction that you'll be able also to get a civil judgment for the amount of the tax.
That certainly makes it more likely. However, it's not. I think it's not necessarily a foregone conclusion. And the civil tax collection procedure can be quite
nothing is certain, but death
right.
and tax.
The civil collection procedure can be quite laborious and time consuming. And so, in this case, the government would prefer to have a restitution order.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Axum, I'll give you 2 minutes.
I'd like to make clear, I know the government has the position that the intent of the parties should govern an interpretation of this contract, and in ordinary contract law that's correct, but the first question or the first rule of interpretation of a contract with the government is that the contract should be construed against the government. That's exactly what the district court did with regard to the restitution in this matter.
Well, it's really against the draftsman, isn't it?
Yes, and in plea agreements.
What is there in the record to suggest that that the government drafted this provision?
Other than that it's on the government's letterhead and signed by the government.
Other than that?
I'd submit that. That's enough.
Cases are exploding.
But In order to divine the intent of the parties, there would have to be some evidence on the record. And I realize the government is pointing to circumstantial evidence that there was a restitution hearing, but the circumstantial evidence that the government points to still does not make the intent of the parties clear. And
why doesn't it tell us what what counsel and defendant were thinking when they signed this?
It's
how they implement it, right?
As Judge Garland pointed out, counsel may have been ineffective as they were discussing this and thinking about this plea agreement. There may not have been a discussion at all. The government is conspicuously absent from the government's brief and argument is that there was specific negotiation about providing the court with unconditional authority to impose restitution. I don't think that I won't speak to things outside the record, but I won't make representations about things outside the record myself, but there is no evidence that there was negotiation about granting the court unconditional authority to impose restitution. There is similarly no evidence that Mr. Anderson intended to be bound by the 2001 guidelines.
Well, I'm not sure I understand that. So the plea agreement says sentencing guidelines paren 2001. And I take it, my recollection is that the plea originally, there's a discussion of, isn't that right? There's a discussion of what the range is?
There is.
And that range is the guidelines range for 2001, right?
That is the estimate provided by counsel, yes.
So that certainly sounds like the parties, at least in the beginning, at the time they signed this document, and even to the time of the plea, thought that the 2001 guidelines would apply. Isn't that right?
Well, the explanation that counsel provides on the record is that when she discussed the sentencing guidelines with Mr. Anderson, she was referring to 2004 guidelines. And there is no difference between the 2004 and 2001. But to come back to the point that you made once before, if counsel was ineffective for not looking back at the 2000 or 1998 guidelines to see if the guidelines had changed, that evidence is not on the record. But it is there also is no evidence that she intended to be bound, or Mr. Anderson intended to be bound.
There certainly is evidence that the government thought that the range was the 2001 range, right? Because that's what was said at the plea.
There's evidence that the government thought that the 2001 range should be considered, not that that was the range that had to be applied.
But that's because of Booker, which requires that no range has to be applied. There was no mention of the 2000 range until a couple days into the sentencing, right?
If I could.
Yes, please.
The first phrase of that plea agreement states that Mr. Anderson, after consideration of the factors contained in 18 U.S.C. Section 3553A, Section 3553 contains as a factor that should be considered the guidelines.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I realize.
Are you saying that you don't think, I mean, let's try to be, you doubt that the government thought that the range was the range of the 2001 guidelines, whether they had the right to rely on that or insist on that, or whether Mr. Anderson knowingly waived it? Do you doubt that they thought that that was the range?
I'm not doubting that the government thought that.
Okay, so if that's the case, and if you are right that there's a problem here, why isn't the appropriate remedy vacating the plea agreement, and you can go to trial, and you're going to risk a trial then? Why is the right remedy rewriting this plea agreement? Normally, we have had many cases in which the defendant thinks the guideline's going to be a certain one. Turns out that because of ineffective assistance, or because of an argument about ineffective assistance, or because the defendant's counsel simply made a mistake, that was wrong, and the defendant seeks to get out of the plea. But I haven't seen a case where the plea's been rewritten. And so why aren't you asking to get out and stand trial?
What I'll say to that is I have not seen the case where the defendant is actually allowed to get out where his counsel provided him an inaccurate estimate, because the ultimate responsibility falls to the court. And the guidelines are what they are. The guidelines that apply to a defendant regardless of any estimate or any hope of the parties. In this plea agreement, the government has included the 2001 guidelines. They have not made 2001 prominent. They have placed it at the end. This is an 11C1C plea agreement. If the government was bent on a guideline range of 108 to 120 months, and the 2001 guidelines were going to say that, regardless of what the defendant thought, then the government could have very clearly articulated that in an 11C1C plea agreement. The government did not do that. The court asked why the plea agreement should not be withdrawn and dismissed, because this was a mistake.
Oh, the district court asked that?
The court.
Or you mean me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
Sorry. But this was a mistake of the government. This was not a mistake of the defendant. And the government reiterates over and over again that this was a mutual mistake. The estimate was certainly a mutual mistake, but the belief that the parties would be bound by the 2001 guidelines was not a mutual mistake, because the plea agreement does not bind the court. The only way the court is bound is by a maximum sentence of 10 years. That was what appeared to be most important to the government in this case. And under the rules of interpretation of contracts with the government, it should be strictly construed against the government. I understand the government is dissatisfied that it may result in a benefit to Mr. Anderson, but Mr. Anderson assumed all the risk in, as most defendants do, in standing before the court and pleading guilty, knowing that the guidelines might not be what they have been estimated to be. The only assurance he had here was that he would not receive a sentence greater than 10 years.
Further questions?
So you did say earlier that The appropriate result then would be to remand and ask the district court whether he really meant to give this as an alternative sentence.
No, not to ask whether he meant to give it as an alternative sentence, but for the district court to provide the reasons
right.
for why the lower sentence, the lower sentencing guideline range, if he had used that as a starting point,
would be appropriate.
Would, or some range between. The district court lost in all of this is that from 57 to 108, there is, or from 71 to 108, there is some range. And the district court settled on the higher guidelines. I don't think that that was by coincidence or by the factors outside of the guidelines that he looked at. That certainly was influenced by the guidelines, and that was error. And we're asking for a remand for the court. Perhaps the court did not even realize that it could sentence between 71 and 108. There is simply nothing on the record to know that. And that is why Booker, Gall, and Rita have repeated that courts should provide the explanations for variances, for sentences themselves. The court provided a sentence, an explanation for the sentence itself, but provided no explanation for a variance, and it was not clear that this was a variance at the sentencing hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Axon. Oh, I'm sorry.
I may be able to provide additional citations later, but I wanted to point the court to page 517 of the transcript appendix, What's that? It is March 23rd of 2007. And page 517, defense counsel discusses with the court the method for calculating the amount of federal restitution.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.